contrary to what you might hear from open borders radicals, we are not asking California, Oakland, or anyone else to actually effectively enforce immigration laws, although we would welcome the positive assistance the majority of jurisdictions in America provide to our federal offices. We would certainly like that. But ICE agents do incredible work every day. They're not backing down. They're not going to be deterred. And we're not going to stop enforcing the law in Alabama or California either, for that matter. We're simply asking the state and other sanctuary jurisdictions to stop actively obstructing federal law enforcement.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions in Sacramento today explaining why the Justice Department is suing California over its sanctuary laws. Sessions was speaking to members of the California Peace Officers Association. The federal suit takes aim at three laws the legislature passed last year aiming to protect undocumented immigrants. In his speech, Sessions said the policies flout federal immigration law, making California less safe. They endanger law enforcement and are ultimately unconstitutional.
There is no nullification. There is no secession. Federal law is the supreme law of the land.
Well, meanwhile, outside.
Brothers and sisters, good morning. Are we ready to resist?
Yes!
Woo! Defend our state?
Yes!
That's Assemblyman David Chu addressing the crowd there. And soon after Sessions spoke, Governor Jerry Brown responded.
This is completely unprecedented for the chief law enforcement of the United States to come out here and engage in a political stunt, make wild accusations, many of which are based on outright lies. That's unusual. And particularly a fellow coming from Alabama talking to us about secession and protecting human and civil rights.
While there was little love lost between California lawmakers and the Trump administration already, this suit promises to take those tensions to a new level. Here to talk about the federal lawsuit against California is Jennifer Chacon. She's a law professor at UC Irvine who specializes in immigration and constitutional law. Hello.
Hi.
Well, briefly remind us about these three laws. What do they do?
Well, the first is Assembly Bill 450, which is the Immigrant Worker Protection Act. And this is a law that essentially tells employers and agents that they won't provide voluntary consent to immigration enforcement agents to enter non-public places of labor. So that's one. The second is Assembly Bill 103, which provides for inspection of facilities that house immigrant detainees. And the third challenge provision is Senate Bill 54, which prohibits state and local officials other than employees of the CDC from providing information regarding a person's release date, responding to requests for notifications by providing release dates or other information, or transferring individuals to immigration authorities.
Okay, so basically, I would imagine that's the one that the feds don't like, right? Because this prohibits local law enforcement from detaining undocumented immigrants so that ICE can then pick them up.
I think they don't like any of these. And so with respect to 54, which I'm sure they don't like, this is one that, as you said, prohibits them from, prohibits the transfer of inmates from state custody to immigration agents unless there's a warrant. So it's prohibiting a warrantless transfer upon administrative request. And it's important to remember that this bill also has a whole host of carve-outs. So anybody who's convicted of certain kinds of crimes, and the list of crimes is quite long, isn't covered by that protection. But this does limit, to a certain extent, the cooperation between state and local officials and federal immigration authorities. But they probably don't like the other two either.
Right. And so the first one that you mentioned, making it a crime for business owners to voluntarily help federal agents find and detain undocumented workers, that one, and also creating a state inspection program for federal immigration detention centers. They don't like those two either?
Yeah. So with regard to the worker piece, the idea would be that if I had a factory and I, as the employer, wanted to consent to ICE entering my factory, that would generally be acceptable under federal law. I could tell them, sure, come on in, this is my factory, and then they could, provided they comply with the dictates of the Fourth Amendment, they could inspect the workplace, they could talk to workers, et cetera. The California law, though, says says, no, you can't voluntarily allow people into your workspace. You need to have a judicial warrant, and that's to protect immigrant workers from sort of being the subject of these arbitrary actions. And this protects, obviously, both citizens and non-citizens to the extent you're going to have ICE agents sort of roaming about in the facility. And I think that was the thought behind the California law. But obviously, federal agents would much prefer to be able to just talk to one person, get consent, and then have access to employer space.
And so all of that, Jeff Sessions says, is obstructing federal immigration law.
Yeah, so this is the complicated question about whether what California is doing is prohibited by or preempted by federal law or not. And that question is obviously not an easy question to answer. So I think California will say, we've researched what federal law requires us to do. We've enacted provisions that don't run afoul of the express requirements of federal law. And we've tried to come up with our own kind of guidelines about how employers or state officials should be treating the residents of the state of California, including immigrant residents of the state of California. And I think the federal government's position here would be, yes, in fact, you do. There are cooperation requirements in federal immigration law, and you also can't impede our obligations as federal officials, and we think that you do that. And the bottom line is, this is not an easy set of questions to resolve. I think there are plausible arguments on both sides, and we've seen this before in cases involving federal preemption and state law. We saw this, for example, in Arizona, when Arizona passed state laws designed to, in that case, assist, quote-unquote, federal immigration enforcement officials with their efforts. And there we saw the court, really taking different approaches with regard to different sections of that law. Some of them were acceptable and in conformity with federal law. Some of them were preempted by federal law. It's very complicated. The doctrine is complicated. And there are lots of holes in the constitutional doctrine that makes this not really a sure-fired win or loss for either side.
Although the Justice Department is citing that Arizona law and the Supreme Court decision that overturned it, ironically, because it was the other side, as you say, this was a law that tried to help federal agents arrest undocumented immigrants. And the Obama administration sued and said, no, you can't preempt federal law. This immigration is a federal issue. And so this Arizona law is unconstitutional. And the court agreed. And so I guess Hsu being on the other foot, Sessions is now citing that decision saying, no, California, you can't preempt federal law. So, I mean, it's kind of ironic, true, but doesn't Sessions have a powerful argument on his side?
Well, so I think if we think about the Arizona case, that case was much more complicated than Sessions is suggesting. So the court said in that case, for example, that the employment-related provision of Arizona law was preempted by federal law. That is, that the federal government had, the power to enact laws governing employment, and that Arizona law ran afoul. On the other hand, the policing provision of that law, the one that the left branded the "Show Me Your Papers" provision, that provision withstood constitutional scrutiny. They said it's fine; it doesn't run afoul. If police want to ask those questions in the course of otherwise legitimate stops, they can go ahead and do that. I think the other thing the Arizona case shows us is that this is an issue because there are plenty of holes in the constitutional case law, where politics matter, and where which judges hear these cases will matter in determining the outcome as they move through the courts.
Well, California judges will hear this case first, right?
Well, we're in federal court because we're dealing with issues of federal preemption. So yes, I mean they will be judges here. But ultimately, this is the kind of case that could well see its way all the way to the Supreme Court.
So we heard Governor Brown being really feisty today,
yeah,
even feistier than normal, if you can believe that, and basically saying that Sessions, the lawsuit and the speech and everything, unprecedented. What do you think? I mean, are we seeing something out of the ordinary here, or are these disputes, have they happened in the past? It's just at this point, they're just becoming more impassioned.
I think we ebb and flow in terms of the level of conflict between the federal government and state and local governments. And certainly, it's not unprecedented to see this kind of attack. I think we can think about the civil rights era and the sort of the reaction of the Jim Crow South to a lot of desegregation efforts. So that certainly is precedent for this sort of back and forth. And I do think we are in a particularly heated moment. It's not the first time we've been in a particularly heated moment. But it is a notable moment.
Jennifer Chacon is a law professor at UC Irvine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to turn to another legal fight involving the Trump administration now. The other side in this case, the adult film actress known as Stormy Daniels. Daniels is suing Trump over a non-disclosure agreement she says he never actually signed. What would that mean, and how may it twist the story of the president and the porn star? We're joined by Lewis Nelson. He's covering the story for Politico. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so she filed the suit yesterday here in L.A. under her real name, Stephanie Clifford, and she basically wants this NDA declared null and void because Donald Trump didn't sign it. Is that the entirety of her case?
Yeah, that's the general gist. The NDA is, NDAs, I think, sort of by their very nature are a little bit furtive and secretive, but this one in particular deals with aliases and things like that. Stormy Daniels is referred to in the document as Peggy Peterson, and there is a blank space for somebody named David Dennison, who was one of the other parties to this non-disclosure agreement. And David Dennison, whoever that is, never signed the document. Now, Stormy Daniels' attorney in an interview this morning came out and said David Dennison is Donald Trump, and because Donald Trump never signed this document, it is completely void.
And the D is for defendant, the P is for plaintiff. Is that the general idea?
I would imagine that that's what it is. That would be some fairly clever alias making up, I guess. That makes sense to me.
Okay, so what is the possible response from David Dennison and his legal team?
David Dennison, whoever that is, we obviously don't know. What we do know, just a couple minutes ago, actually, the White House press briefing just wrapped up, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about this. She said the president has denied this, continues to deny the allegations that he had an affair with Stormy Daniels. I was talking to my colleagues around the newsroom, and none of us can completely remember when the president actually came out and denied this sort of outright. Michael Cohen has been the person doing most of the talking on this. But Sarah Sanders came out and said the president denies this, and the president wasn't aware of this payment when Michael Cohen made it, which matches with what Michael Cohen has said. Michael Cohen has said that he made the payment out of his own money and has not been reimbursed by the Trump Organization, was not reimbursed by the Trump campaign, notably has not said that he was not reimbursed by President Donald Trump personally. But that's been the response from the White House thus far.
Mm-hmm. And basically saying Donald Trump is basically saying, I didn't know this existed. I never had this affair. This NDA was initiated solely on the part of my lawyer, Michael Cohen, and I had no knowledge of that.
Yeah, so that's sort of the confusing part, right, is Michael Cohen has admitted to being part of this non-disclosure agreement. His name is on it. His signature is on it, representing the company that served as a conduit to get Stormy Daniels this money. And it's not clear. He hasn't said he hasn't, talked very much about who the non-disclosure agreement is shielding at all. But he is Donald Trump's attorney. And so it's, I think that's obviously the big question. There's significant reason to believe, including an interview from Stormy Daniels herself, which she gave in 2011, well before this non-disclosure agreement would have even been a twinkle in Michael Cohen's eye, that went into some, not as explicit as she could have, but some pretty clear detail as to, about her sexual relationship with the president.
Yeah. Okay. And so it also raises a question, if it is just Michael Cohen who paid her off, why wasn't that declared on official campaign documents that you have to file with the FEC? This happened just a few weeks before the election, right?
Right. So that is one way people who are trying to get to the bottom of this, you might call them, I'm sure the president would refer to them as his opponents, but people trying to get to the bottom of this, opponents of the president, reporters, things like that, have pursued this as a campaign law issue, whether this was a contribution or there's all sorts of laws pertaining to how you can spend money and how presidential candidates and presidential campaigns can spend money on things like the, on things, you know, pertaining to the campaign, obviously. And certainly I think this would be something that you could quite clearly argue would pertain to the campaign. And so that's one way that folks are trying to pursue this and get the information out in the open and you know, get kind of, like I was saying, get to the bottom of it.
Louis Nelson is a reporter with Politico. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, the fight over rent control here in California. It's getting heated. Next on Press Play. It's Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Over the next couple of days, we're going to dig in to a key part of our current housing crisis, and that's rising rents. And one way cities try to deal with that, rent control. Rent control. You're either for it or you're against it. Here's KCRW's Saul Gonzalez.
Oh, lovely. Ramen Sherry's Santa Monica apartment is pretty terrific. On the fifth floor of an oceanfront building, her two-bedroom, two-bath place is sunny and spacious, with Instagram-ready views.
I love the morning sun. Southern exposure works for me.
And I can see the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
And the beach.
And Catalina on a clear day.
Robin's had this view for a long time. She moved here 35 years ago when she was 25 and working as a secretary at a film studio.
I paid $421 in 1983. I mean, who didn't love that?
In the decades since, Robin's rent has gone up, and it's not the cheapest you can find. But for an apartment this size and at this location, what she's paying in 2018 is still a deal.
It's $1,615.43.
You know it down to the penny.
I do.
Robin pays that relatively bargain amount because Santa Monica is one of 15 California cities, including Los Angeles and San Francisco, with rent control laws on the books. Those laws limit how much landlords can raise rents from one year to the next. And they're getting more attention now as anxiety over the cost of housing grows in California.
As an instrument of keeping housing affordable, how important is rent control to you?
It's absolutely essential.
That's Dean Preston, executive director of Tenants Together, a statewide renters advocacy group. He says affordable rental housing should be a right and regulated pretty much like an essential utility.
It's no different than any other necessity in life, right? We don't want our water prices to be determined by what Nestle or some other company decides is the price they can get for water, and the same with other basic human needs. And housing is one of those. And rent control is a proven tool to stabilize prices.
But how well does rent control really work as a way to protect affordable housing? To find out, we can stay in Santa Monica, but we need to go back to 1979. That's when voters in the city, worried about escalating housing costs and evictions, passed one of the most sweeping rent control laws in the country. Denny Zane, a one-time mayor of Santa Monica, was a young housing advocate then and remembers tenants' fears.
Well, they had literally no protections, no eviction protections. There were no limits on rent increases at all. It was just whatever the landlord would do.
No limits.
No limits. And it was not uncommon. Back in those days, you know, $100 a month rent increase was a whopper.
When Santa Monica voters approved rent control in 1979, they also created an elected five-member board. It determines how much landlords can raise rents, usually 1 to 3% a year based on the Consumer Price Index. For many renters, those incremental increases are the difference between having a home and not having one.
Rent control means what to you?
It means everything.
Now in her 60s and retired and living off of savings after a serious back injury, Robin Sherry says rent control has let her live a decent life in good times and bad.
So it's allowed me to do other things. When things were better for me financially, it allowed me to travel. I didn't have to think about what I needed to buy. I could just buy it because my money wasn't going to my rent. I couldn't be happier. I owe so much to rent control.
But Santa Monica landlords and some residents say rent control has been a colossal mistake, driven by a political agenda instead of an understanding of economics.
The political agenda was to make Santa Monica a laboratory for a utopian progressive theme park, if you will, in which every progressive ideology could be implemented.
That's Wes Wellman, a longtime Santa Monica realtor and apartment building owner. He says rent control has failed to do what it was supposed to do in Santa Monica, keep housing affordable and the community economically diverse.
So over time, rent control changed the demographics of Santa Monica from being a middle-income suburban community to a high-income, largely white haven for affluent single people.
Now, in the years since Santa Monica enacted rent control, the city has boomed with revived shopping areas, new attractions, and thousands of new jobs. But Santa Monica hasn't become more affordable to live in. Actually, quite the opposite. The city has some of the highest housing prices in the country, with one-bedroom apartments regularly renting for over $3,000 a month. Robin Sherry says if you moved into her building today, you'd be paying way more in rent for a smaller place than she does.
I would say somewhere around $37,000, $54,000 a month for a one bedroom, one bath.
Paying as your neighbor.
Paying as my neighbor.
Santa Monica has also lost a lot of rental housing since rent control was passed, with hundreds of apartments turned into pricier condos. Critics say that's happened here and in other cities with rent control because telling landlords what rent they can charge removes incentives to create new housing. Why build new apartments or even maintain existing ones, developers and landlords say, if rent control limits how much they can earn?
I mean, rent control has never built one single unit, ever.
Tom Bannon heads the California Apartment Association, an industry trade group.
I think that when you say rent control, you're basically talking about controlling somebody's livelihood.
But eliminate rent control, says Bannon, and incentives would return to build more housing, and rents in Santa Monica and other cities would go down. Housing advocates say that's bunk. They argue rents are rising in cities with rent control because of state laws that have weakened it. Renters' rights advocate Dean Preston says without rent control, housing affordability would be even worse in hot real estate markets like Santa Monica, Los Angeles, and San Francisco.
It's absolutely a success story. Anyone who looks at a hot real estate market, a city like San Francisco, for example, and thinks that there would be low-income people, communities of color, left in a city like San Francisco without rent control, I'd like to know how they think that would have happened. Now, even with rent control, the higher-priced cities are losing communities of color, large-scale displacement, but it is a fraction of what it would be without rent control. If all of these units were allowed to be at market level when you have a booming economy, everyone would be priced out except for very rich people.
But some also question the fairness of rent control. Is it right for some people to pay much lower rents than others, often in the same building, just because they moved in much earlier and had their rents locked in? Many landlords advocate raising rents if a tenant's income increases. When I bring up the fairness issue with Robin, she looks at me like I'm nuts.
Yeah, you are crazy. Why not? I think if somebody else got in when I did, they would feel the same way. I just happened to be lucky enough to get in when I did.
No rent control guilt.
None. Not one bit.
Santa Monica isn't a haven of housing affordability, but that hasn't dampened enthusiasm for rent control. Tomorrow, we'll tell you about the grassroots campaign to bring rent control to more local cities.
We need to fight. When we fight, we win.
For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
We made it easy for you to find out more about rent control in California on our website. Go to kcrw.com/curious to read about where there's rent control in the state and what it means for housing. Coming up, a new movie by the creator of Veep explores the power grab in Russia after Joseph Stalin's sudden death in 1953. It's a comedy, but also a cautionary tale.
This story is
is about now. It's not set in a land far away and long, long ago. I want it to feel immediate and right in front of you. You know, it could happen again.
Armando Iannucci is here to talk about his new movie, The Death of Stalin, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Beginning in 1929, Joseph Stalin presided over the transformation of the Soviet Union from a peasant-based economy to an industrial superpower. Along the way, millions of people were killed, either from starvation or from being murdered outright. Millions more were sent to deplorable gulags. So it might seem a little odd to make a comedy about the terror of Stalin's reign, his final days, and his death in 1953.
Comrades, now that we're quiet, I propose we call a doctor.
All the best doctors are in the gulag. Or dead.
Yes. Yes, because they tried to kill the boss.
So any doctor still in Moscow is not a good doctor.
What are people's thoughts on getting a bad doctor?
Well, the man who brought us the TV show Veep has done just that. He's made a comedy about Stalin's death and the chaos that ensued after. Armando Iannucci wrote and directed The Death of Stalin. It stars Steve Buscemi, Michael Palin, and Jeffrey Tambor, among others. And Armando Iannucci joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, okay, so that scene there was just after Stalin suffered a stroke that would be fatal, and his inner circle is wondering just what to do because Stalin had purged all the best doctors. So
that's right.
That sounds super absurd and comedic, but it really happened, right?
It really happened. A lot of the most bizarre and absurd and funny stuff in the film is based on true events. I mean, the film opens with a concert playing on Radio Moscow, live from a concert hall. Stalin rings up and asks for a recording of it, and they realize they aren't recording it. They're not taping it. It's going out live. And they're absolutely terrified, and they run out and lock the doors and tell the audience to come back in, and they're going to do it all again for Stalin.
Don't worry. Nobody's going to get killed. I promise you. This is just a musical emergency. Take your seats. That's it. Nobody be alarmed. It's fine. Sit down. Do not defy me. Sit your...
And then the conductor faints out of fear and knocks himself unconscious. And they have to get another conductor in, who comes in the middle of the night and conducts it in his pyjamas. And all of that is true. And, you know, that's what attracted me to the story, really. It's, you know, it's got these big, important themes about, you know, the state and terror and dictatorship. But it's also, bizarrely... I mean, you say it's a comedy, but that's not to say that we're laughing at the misfortune of the people in the Soviet Union at the time. We show that in all its detail and reality. It's the absurdity of the behavior of those in Stalin's inner circle, really.
Yeah, well, right. And the old adage, tragedy plus time equals comedy. Certainly.
Yeah, except, you know, after we shot the film, I went back and looked again at Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, which he made in 1941 about Hitler.
Right.
And, you know, so there's no, there's tragedy plus very little time, really. It was contemporary with what was happening. And yet it contains moments of high slapstick from Chaplin and also scenes in the Jewish ghetto. And for some reason, you know, the fact that it's pushed through the lens of comedy, somehow it sort of feels like that's the only way you can tackle the subject in any kind of honest way, because the subject is so appalling and yet so horrifying and absurd that you have to recognize the absurdity as well as the horror.
Did you ever worry, though, that you would go too far and that you would actually make light of some very serious and horrific incidents?
Well, two things. One is, you know, a lot of care and preparation went into the making of the film. So we did a lot of research. We, you know, went out to Moscow, researched the look of the place, spoke to people who grew up under that system, asked them what it was like, you know, waking up every day thinking, will I get through the day? The measures they took. I mean, they said they would go to bed at night wearing lots of layers of clothing so that if they were, you know, someone knocked on the door in the middle of the night and took them off to the gulag, they would at least have lots of clothes with them. So we put that in the film. So all this preparation. And then, you know, in the post, in the edit, there is time to then look at what we've shot and make sure you've got the best balance where the comedy and the tragedy are supporting each other and are underlining each other rather than pulling each other apart. You know, that's so there is an element of going into it thinking quite deliberately, you know, I'm outside. I want to push myself beyond my comfort zone here because that's kind of what I want the audience to feel.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have the safety net of, you know, 4 or 5 months afterwards to make sure the story as we finally lay it out is the right story and feels like it's got the right balance of you know, serious subject matter and yet, you know, bizarre, funny farce with entertaining performances and a story that's based on truth.
I have to say also, and I think this is the British way, but we're not used to it here in the United States, that having the actors use their real accents, their English and American accents, and not put on Russian accents makes it funnier.
Well, good. But I mean, that was one of the first decisions I said. And really what was interesting is that a lot of Russians who've seen the film, and that's Russian media and press, as well as cinema goers, they've all said, thank you for not using fake Russian accents, because we hate that. And what they were saying is, there are so many Russian accents, and we would get the wrong one, because it's a vast... Mm. In fact, it wasn't just Russia, it was the Soviet Union. It was Russia, Ukraine, Georgia. I mean, Stalin was Georgian, so he could speak a wholly different language if he wanted to. It was a huge landmass. It was, you know, a massive percentage of the globe covered by this reign and this government. And to get that sense of, you know, a diversity of cultures, I thought, let's do it in English. We're going to use English rather than a sort of something that sounds artificial, but we'll do a variety of English accents. So we've got Scottish, we've got Irish, we've got American, we've got European, but all in English.
And who is Stalin? What accent does he have?
He has a sort of a Cockney, an East End London accent. and it's also because, although I'm looking at something from 1953 and in Moscow, I want to say this story is about now. It's not set in a land far away and long, long ago. I want it to feel immediate and right in front of you. You know, it could happen again. It's about what happens when you think... You know, don't think that because you have a democracy that you have the perfect system and that it won't change and that it won't deteriorate. So it's about being alert to what could happen now.
Okay, let me play another clip of tape. This is during the funeral.
Yeah.
And this is when Khrushchev, played by Steve Buscemi, has to oversee the funeral. He's got to plan the whole thing. He's not happy about it because he thinks he's being sidelined. So here he is with some of the others of Stalin's inner circle at the wake.
Jesus Christ, it's the bishops.
I thought we'd banned those freaks.
Sneeze on the bastards as they go past.
Did you invite them?
No.
Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Don't give me orders. Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Did you invite the bishops?
Yes.
Yes.
Well?
He said yes.
I'm going to give everyone in Red Square a voucher permitting one kick each to his stupid face.
And they're saying this as the crowds of mourners go past them, you know, only feet away, and they can't move. So they're having to kind of pass these messages on as they surround Stalin's body lying in state. And we made that scene. I had a look at the, you know, the coverage of the actual funeral, and we tried to recreate the look as much as possible. And there you do see Beria and Khrushchev and Molotov all around the body. So we thought that's where our, you know, we can have a crucial scene take place where they can't move.
But and that is also what people are always wondering, like, what are these people thinking? What are they actually saying to each other?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we found out during Donald Trump's inauguration what former President George W. Bush was actually saying. I think he said something like, "This is really freaky stuff," or something like
that.
Some weird stuff. Or
yeah, he was. Yeah, he was slightly ruder, but
No,
I know exactly what he said. Yeah.
That's what it reminded me of.
Thus echoing the thoughts of literally millions. More millions, more than had ever seen an inauguration ever before, period.
I know. Watching that, though, you haven't been at the helm of Veep for a couple of seasons now. Does that make you pine to get back into it?
Oh, God, no. because I think, you know, you can't, how can you fictionalize what's actually happening now? Things that people didn't think would ever happen are happening. People are being elected who no one 4 or 5 years ago ever thought stood a chance of being elected. So something weird is happening there, something unstable and unpredictable. And in these unpredictable moments in time, you know, terrible things can happen unless people are alert to it. You know, sorry to be sound so doom laden there. I mean, it is a comedy, but it's sort of that. You know, what is happening is, you know, you read Fire and Fury, and you read, you know, anything any day about what's going on in Washington, and it just it jumps the shark that already had been jumped the day before.
Yeah. So looking back over your career, it does seem that you are interested in the absurd comedy of absolute power, or of people who want it, or people, what they're willing to do to get it.
But it's also kind of human beings, you know, not showing that these people are human. They're not, it's not like a monster wakes up and thinks, you know, what evil thing will I do today? It's more someone who's acquired power and in the process has so compromised their own set of values that they genuinely do believe that anything they do is far better for the country than anything anyone else can do, you know. And it's trying to show how that happens, really.
So Selina Meyer is not so different from Nikita Khrushchev.
I don't think she's...
Did she take her shoe off and bang it on the...
She's certainly taking her shoe off, but it's mostly because her feet are hurting rather than to demonstrate some point. I mean, what I'd say about Selina Meyer is that she's not a criminal. She's not, you know, she went into politics for the best of reasons. She genuinely wanted to do good, and we see how she... what compromises she made, but also what she didn't compromise on as well, and you know, how that affects her. It's also really a commentary on what we want out of our politicians, because I sort of think it's unrealistic. You know, we expect them to be perfect, that not to have any kind of blemish in their past, to be able to answer a question perfectly whenever a camera or a microphone is put in front of them, to have a policy for everything, and to do it 24 hours a day without taking a break. You know, we expect that of them now, and that is impossible, and we have to work out ourselves what are the limits of politics as well as the kind of the ideals, I think.
Yeah. And so it's kind of nice to see them humanized, even if they are, I mean, monsters, really.
But I also say, you know, it's part of it is about me saying to the audience, what would you do if you were in their place?
Right.
You know, would you do anything differently, really? I'm not sure I would. I'm sure I'd make as many mistakes if I was in that position.
So you're talking about Veep as well as Death of Stalin.
Oh, I wouldn't have people killed, you know.
That's certainly where you draw the line.
Certainly not in the first 5 to 10 years of my time in office. Maybe once we get into year 30, you know, it might be time to, you know, get rid of lots of the dead wood and bring some new people in, some fresh blood.
Well, Armando Iannucci, it's been so much fun speaking with you. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Armando Iannucci on The Death of Stalin. You can see it beginning tomorrow in theaters. Coming up, how to tell if your favorite Instagram star is being paid to dish out that lifestyle advice. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Shudu Graham has nearly 70,000 Instagram followers and an association with Rihanna's makeup line. Fenty reposted a picture of her wearing one of its lipsticks, the Saw C shade, to be exact. Well, to be further exact, Shudu Graham isn't real. Pseudogram is a digital fake, a sexy avatar, which kind of encapsulates the whole problem with Instagram influencers. How real are they?
Tap on that. That looks so cool. Yeah. Okay, so we're doing the Hydra facial.
And how real is their advice, whether it be for makeup tips, detox tea, or mental health care? Rosie Spinks has been covering this corner of the internet and wrote about seeking out a lifestyle coach on Instagram for Quartz. And she's here now. Hi, Rosie.
Hi there.
Well, what we're talking about is people who have a lot of followers because they're able to basically curate a lifestyle online that is really attractive. Some of them get paid by brands that want to be associated with them and that lifestyle. So where does mental health care fit into all of that?
So, I mean, life coaches have existed, you know, for years, but Instagram life coaches are sort of a subset of this that I became very interested in, you could maybe say obsessed, for a while. And you know, they do talk about mental health, but the way into that is often a little more subtle. You know, they're sharing about their own lives and their own struggles and vulnerabilities and maybe, you know, habits or tricks they do to improve, you know, stay well mentally. And then they may start marketing sessions or courses or downloadable audios that their followers can use to sort of emulate their habits and their mental health advice. So it takes a lot of different forms, but this kind of intersection of wellness, mental health, spirituality, and living your best life is definitely where these Instagram life coaches fall.
And do they all have a similar kind of approach like that? Like it's all about living your best life and, I don't know, mindfulness, slowing down?
Yeah, it's kind of a sort of patois of Eastern spirituality, modern wellness trends. There's not a lot of rigor to sort of what they're presenting, to use a kind of nauseating internet phrase, your vibe attracts your tribe, sometimes people say. So they're trying to kind of be, so, quote unquote, authentic for their followers and give their followers a window into their life. And then in turn, they are offering advice to these followers either on a social media network like Instagram, but also taking that offline or off social media to one-to-one sessions via Skype. In the story you're referencing, I hired one that did not have any formal life coach training, though she did have a background in psychology.
And did it work?
It's a good question. So it certainly exceeded my expectations. I wouldn't say that I went into it cynically, but I did go into it sort of a skeptic. But I also was, I would be lying if I said I wasn't drawn to this woman's life and what she presented on Instagram. So what I really wanted to know is, will she seem this nice and spiritual and curious, you know, off of this medium? And to be honest, she did.
And how do you know that she is who she says she is? You know, I mean, I led the segment off by talking about this fake model on Instagram, this digital avatar. And when you look at her picture, you can see it when you know. But, you know, oftentimes you don't know what's real and what's fake.
Sure. And oftentimes you don't know if the, you know, wellness trend a life coach or influencer is espousing is something they're being paid for or not. But many life coaches and many of these influencers know that what they're actually selling is this feeling of connection online. And if they can then parlay that into commercial gain, that's kind of the dream. And what's interesting about this model you brought up, you know, the connection or the sort of fandom that the followers feel for this model is real. I mean, they wouldn't be following her and engaging and commenting if it weren't. But what isn't real is her. And the same can be said for a lot of this world of influencing. I mean, the engagement and the connection is real. But there are so many forces that mediate that are invisible. And those forces kind of determine what's behind the curtain.
And as the person who is receiving all of this or going online and being influenced, is there a way that you can know?
That's a good question. That's kind of what's drawn me to this line of reporting. I think I've noticed that when I get obsessed with certain corners of Instagram, it's sort of my lizard brain that gets obsessed. It's like I can't look away kind of thing. And then when I think about it intellectually and I think about what's going on, then it gets a little creepy why I'm so interested in the short clip you played, you know, someone putting on a face mask or someone making a matcha latte. Why is this so compelling? And out of all the ways I could be spending my attention, why am I doing it with on this? And my reporting on this topic has sort of not made me particularly positive about the effects that it can have when we think about it, you know, rationally, not with that lizard brain.
Yeah. Well, another story that you did focused on Instagram influencers dispensing advice on ditching birth control.
Yeah. So there was sort of actually one of the life coaches I followed first. I saw this, that they were posting about their temperature reading. So one of the ways you can use non-hormonal birth control is a basal body temperature reading. And it's a certain startup called Natural Cycles, which has an app and sells this temperature. And then I searched that hashtag and I found lots of sponsored posts from wellness influencers, fashion bloggers, the kinds of people we're talking about, who were telling their followers the benefits of using hashtag hormone-free birth control. So this to me was so striking that something as sort of personal and complicated and with such high consequences as, you know, preventing pregnancy could also now be conflated with natural beauty products and, you know, lattes.
I love the line in your piece where you say that this fits into the idea of a culture that is obsessed with elimination as a form of aspiration, be it dairy, screen time, chemicals, or gluten.
Yeah, and I think that's a unifying theme of a lot of Instagram culture, you know. You could say it's a broader thing of wellness culture, but this removal of toxins and gluten and carbohydrates and maybe negativity and bad vibes. I mean, you name it. There's lots of removal of bad things. But we don't often, you know, we listen to these influencers and we can't look away, but we don't necessarily think about what's motivating them to tell us to, you know, stop using a birth control pill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, there's all sorts of really even dodgier advice online, you know, like to, if you've got some allergic reaction, you should take this particular food allergy test and this use this kind of product that might cure it. I mean, you know, who knows whether or not that'll work.
Right. And the problem is that because of the nature of, you know, the attention economy and short captions, these things are often not presented with a lot of nuance. So I think that's the problem. And the connection people feel with the influencer sort of trumps the details and trumps, you know, maybe what's motivating them to post something. So it's, yeah, to go back to your question, you know, how can we be more critical of that? I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm still figuring it out.
Rosie Spinks, she writes about internet culture for Quartz. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Christian
Hey
Bordahl.
There, Madeline Brand.
You're here with some feedback.
I am. Just quick, we got a lot of feedback about rent control. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Jesse Flores says, if they want to charge $2,500 a month, then employers should start their medium wage at around $90,000 a year. May seem extreme, but rent mortgage should be one-third of your income. Sean Panzer says it should be part of the mix. No one idea is going to be the solution. Data and Politics, however, says it works for those who have it, makes things worse for those who don't. Did a little Twitter poll, as I often do. 62% of our listeners say yes, good idea, rent control. Only 9% say it's a bad idea. 18% say it's not the greatest idea, but we do need it. And that leaves 11% who say, eh, beats me.
Okay. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl.
Yep.
I'm Madeline Brand. Steve Chutakis will be here Thursday and Friday, so I'll see you on Monday.